Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Sober Indians Live. I'm Karen, your host, and tonight we have Patrick McCoy, founder of Sober Indians, joining us. So let's welcome Patrick to the show. Hi, Patrick. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Glad to be here and glad to be able to share on the show, and I'm glad we got the show. Thank you, Karen, for doing an outstanding job as our announcer and holding the show down. And then you've had all kinds of good speakers on the show, and all the speakers have been in people from, you know, in recovery from alcohol and drug abuse. And so, you know, that's what Sober Indians is about. And, you know, again, going back to how I got sober, I mean, I was a hopeless, helpless alcoholic, and I didn't know what I was. And I started at a very young age drinking. I think I was 11, 12 years old. And then it wasn't because my parents drank. It was, you know, my parents, they had they didn't watch me. You know, it was like I was an unattended child. And not that that was, you know, they were mistreating me or anything. It was that, you know, they just thought I was okay. And so, again, I didn't, you know, I got into other things when I was, you know, just running around. I was running the streets. I could stay at my cousin's and, you know, just disappear. And then, you know, they let me go places. They weren't strict. And they were good parents. They were very loving parents. And they weren't abusive. And they didn't drink, and drinking wasn't in my house. So I didn't experience that with them. I didn't see my father drunk, or I didn't see my mom drunk. And I seen him tipsy, my mother, one time, and then that was it. But for me, I remember my grandmother, she used to drink all the time. And she lived with us, and she was old, and she used to drink like Pabst Blue Ribbon. They called them jumbos back in the day. And then she chewed Copenhagen, and she was a fluent Ojibwe language speaker, and she was full-blooded Ojibwe. And She would talk in English, but when she drank, she would start, you know, talking in the language. And she would ask my brothers and sisters in the Anishinaabe language to go get her stuff. And, you know, they say, "Grandma, we can't understand you." And so my mother said, when I was born, she said, "I'm going to teach Patrick to speak Indian, you know, the language." And, you know, that's what they said, Indian. You know, I know Indians are not, you know, we're not from India, but I mean, we all grew up around here. We're Indians. And then, you know, it was a correct term for us, and we were okay with it. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. it wasn't an issue. So, you know, things like that, you know, she spoke the language to me. And then I think I was 4 or 5 years old, you know, and then my grandmother died. And so my mother spoke the language, but she wasn't, she didn't speak it fluently, and she didn't speak it only when her friends would come around. She would talk in the language sometimes, and they would just talk and use different words. And so, you know, it was something we, you know, we just picked up little words like, you know, aning means hello, and then bojo, hello, or miigwech is thank you. And then, you know, just, you know, animals, and dog was namush, you know, simple things like that. And that was like the extent of like the language. And so I was raised knowing, you know, all kinds of different Indian people because, you know, all my cousins were Indian. Well, you know, we're all, a lot of, most of us were mixed blood, you know. We weren't 100% Indian. We were mixed bloods. And so, we just all kind of hung together. I went to the school called Malcolm, and I mean, I was related to, you know, like a quarter of the school. And so my cousins were there, and then, you know, and that's when I started experimenting. I used to hang around my cousins, and, you know, they did different things, you know, and we were all young experimenting, and we didn't know anything about self-esteem or self-worth or addiction or anything like that. We didn't understand anything like that. We just, you know, I remember huffing gas with my cousin Randy, and then, you know, getting that feeling, and it was a good feeling. And so I didn't know that, you know, we're killing brain cells and, you know, things like that. And then our older cousins, you know, they drank, and so they gave us a little, you know, they gave us something to drink. And then, so I ended up, you know, experimenting, and, you know, when I drank, I remember I felt, you know, like a relief when I drank. I really felt like the stress of life left me, you know. So I just drank to get drunk, you know, right away. And that's what they say in treatment. They say alcoholic drinks for effect. A social drinker drinks to be social. And, you know, yeah, I drank to be social, but I drank to get drunk because I didn't want to feel. And, you know, and I didn't know how to feel, and I didn't know how to talk about my feelings really because, you know, in that era, like my parents, they didn't talk about their feelings, you know. They didn't, you know, there was, you know, they loved us, but the word, you know, I love you wasn't used. I mean, they showed us they loved us, but they didn't say it. You know, it was like, you know, it was just the way that it was. They grew up in that era where it was, you know, they were tough and they didn't show a lot of different emotion. And so, you know, learning about my feelings and learning about, I felt unique because of, you know, the addiction and getting high and then realizing that it was causing me damage from, you know, I started sniffing gas, and then we were sniffing hairspray and then glue, and then just we did everything, you know, and we all would get together. There would be about five or six of us, and we'd, you know, be huffing gas or drinking, or, you know, at that time we were smoking pot, you know, and my parents, you know, they didn't really notice, like, you know, what I was doing. Only one time I got caught sniffing gas because I came in the house and I smelled like a gas can. And my dad didn't know anything about it. And I remember him saying, he goes, boy, he said, you smell like gas. He goes, boy, what the heck are you? And then he said, come here. And then he smelled me. He goes, you've been sniffing gas? And I'm like, no. And he goes, you've been sniffing gas, Pat. And then anyways, he talked to me about that. And he said, don't do that, you know, and I didn't for a while, and then I did again, and then went back to, you know, life was, you know, when you're an addict, you know, you get high and you get used to that exciting high, euphoria. And when you come off of that, life is just bland and plain. So it wasn't, it was just too plain life for me. So I felt like I wanted to be high or drunk, you know, all the time. And so, and at that time, being a young kid, I was doing really well in school. You know, and I wondered why I could do that. I would, you know, like after I sniffed all the gas and everything, I'd go to school and I was, you know, getting all A's and, you know, considered one of the smartest kids in our school from fifth and sixth grade in Malcolm School. The teachers were always, you know, saying, man, Patrick, you're so smart. And I remember doing tests and everything, and I'd get done, you know, before everybody. And I'm like, I wonder why I'm like this, you know. I'd sit there and look at the other kids. They're doing their tests, and I'd have mine done right away. And it just seemed like the answers would always come to me right away. And I just knew the answers, and I could read stuff, and I get it right away. And so it made me feel unique, really, too. And so anyway, but my addiction got worse and worse. By the time I got to junior high, which was seventh grade, I was just really lost and screwed up, and, you know, from smoking weed and from drinking, and then I would miss classes, and because I missed classes, I got behind, and that's what happened to a lot of kids, you know, that struggle with their academics. Is what I've come to know is, you know, they've missed classes because they were sick or whatever. And, you know, it's really important to, when you go to school, to get to your classes, because, you know, it's the steps of, you know, your academics is to be in class and to learn the steps of whatever you're learning. And that's how you understand your material. So anyways, I realized this all after I got sober, but I would drink, and then I had a thing. My dad let me drive. We'd drive on Sugar Island, which was a place where, you know, a lot of people didn't live. You had to take a ferry across. So my dad tried to, you know, get me to do different things so I wouldn't, you know, I would stay busy and be healthy, you know. But, you know, I got down there. I was driving. I had my own little, actually bought me a Volkswagen, and I was driving that around the island, and it was kind of like a go-kart, really. And so I loved to drive. So I would drive, and it did keep me out of trouble. But, you know, I just kept falling back to wanting to use, and that's what I did. And I didn't understand why. And emotionally, too, when I didn't have something to use, or if I couldn't drink something or smoke weed, I would have these I'd get angry, and I'd be very hyper or very sensitive, and I would react, and I got angry. And I mean, I got really angry. I'd get very angry at my mother, and I just was wondering, why am I like this emotionally, you know? And so it was it was a strange feeling, and it made me feel weird, and it made me feel bad. You know, I mean, I felt bad about myself, and I'm like, why do I talk? You know, I said bad things to my mother, and, you know, my mother loved me, and my father loved me, and they would do anything for me. But the addiction had me, and I didn't know it, and they didn't know it. And so we were all, you know, wondering, why is Pat the way that he is, you know what I mean? I'd get emotional and angry, and, you know, I just, because I, and then I thought, you know, because of my youth, I got paranoid, you know, and my thinking was negative, and I looked at, you know, instead of seeing the sun shining, you know, it was always, you know, to me, it was like everything was, you know, it was raining and it was, you know, dark. It was a dark life. And I was ashamed, and I knew every time that I used that I was wrong. And I always felt like I was wrong. I constantly felt like I was wrong. And so, I get caught doing different things that I wasn't supposed to be doing. And then, you know, and then people would say stuff, and then I got kicked out of school. And then, you know, I was wondering, why am I like this? What's going on? Why am I, you know, it was just a terrible feeling. I felt alone, unique, different. And that's the way it was in my addiction, really, always. You know, it was like a terminal uniqueness, and it always felt bad. And I felt I would have good times, you know, at different times, but usually something bad would happen after, you know, something good happened. So I wanted to be around my friends. My friends were all drinking and using, but, you know, something would happen. You know, I drank and I would black out. I was blacking out as a young man. And then, you know, someone would tell me, they say, Pat, you know, you did this last night. I'm like, really? And I'm like, yeah, you did that. And you said this. And I'm like, really? I mean, I couldn't remember what I said, and I said things that were embarrassing, you know, and I just felt ashamed of myself always, you know. And so anyway, because I like driving, I ended up, you know, I get drunk and then I'd steal cars. And so this one time, I had my sister buy for me. She went and got me a fifth of schnapps, and then I drank that, and then I jumped in this one car and stole that, and then I ended up hitting seven cars. I'm glad I didn't hurt anybody, and then I hit a tree. But I think I was like 13 years old when I did that, 13 or 14, and so I knew I was getting locked up then. And so I got, you know, my world was falling down around me, and I became suicidal. And my dad, he was, you know, he was trying to help me, and he's like, Pat, you can't drink, you can't do this. And he tried to understand me, tried to talk to me, my mom did. And I remember my cousin having a party where me and my dad were on Sugar Island. He took me down there. You know, it was like we had a cabin down there to keep me out of trouble. But that night, my cousin was having a party, and this was after I'd stolen that car. And so my dad came and got me at the party, and then I was embarrassed. So I said, you know, I'm going to kill myself. And so I remember my dad bringing me back to the cabin, and then so I took a bunch of pills, and they brought me back over to the mainland, my dad did, on an emergency ferry, and they pumped my stomach, and then, you know, I woke up, and I remember my arms were tied down. I was in a gurney, you know, on the bed, and they said that I was going to a psychiatric ward in Traverse City, a mental institution for, you know, troubled youth. And I was thinking, boy, you know, I said, that's probably where I belong, you know. I kind of felt relieved. I'm like, you know, I'm crazy, so this might be where I got to go, you know. And so I remember my sister coming in there telling me, you know, you're going here. How do you feel about that? And I said, well, I feel kind of good about that, you know. So anyway, I ended up going to Traverse City, and And they didn't put me on any medication, and they didn't tell me I was an alcoholic or addict or anything. I just had, like I was a master manipulator, and I had behavioral issues. And at that time, it was, you know, young people weren't really in AA, you know what I mean? So they didn't have, like, AA for young people. So, I mean, I could have qualified for NA or AA, you know, back when I was 13 years old. Because I was a full-blown addict alcoholic. Anyway, so I'm there, and I was there, and I did very well for long periods of time. But as soon as they'd give me a little rope, you know, I'd do something again over there. And I tried to escape 3 or 4 times. I got a ways, and then they'd catch me and bring me back. I finally, you know, I spent over a year there, then they took me out of there. And I remember the stigma. Everybody knew that I was in a psychiatric ward as a kid. So, I mean, I felt like everybody knew that. So it was like everybody was talking about that, you know, Patty's crazy and he stole that car and he tried to kill himself. And, you know, and I was ashamed of all that. So I just heard the voices of other people talking about me, per se, even if they weren't talking about me. You know what I mean? And so I had that stuff going on in my head all the time. Anyway, so I tried to stay away from drinking and drugging, and I did for, I think, 3 or 4 months. I wouldn't go to any parties or go. I wouldn't go with my friends. My dad had a taxi company, and I was he would have me dispatch for the taxi drivers, and I would sit there, and you know, at that time, that's when they had HBO first came on, and I'd watch HBO on the TV. I thought I was the king, and then you know, tell the drivers where to go on their runs and all that. And then we'd eat pizza or whatever. I ate out all the time. And my dad would pay me $5 for 12 hours of work, so which was not a lot. But I had some good fringe benefits like pizza and, you know, good food all the time. But anyway, I ended up going and, you know, drinking. And, again, you know, I drank to get drunk when I drank. I didn't drink one drink. I drank a lot, and I drank and drank when I drank. You know, I just wanted to keep drinking, you know, because I didn't want to deal with the shame of being wrong. I knew that I shouldn't be doing it. I was guilty, and I was ashamed of myself, and there I am back again. I'm doing it again. And so I didn't understand why I was doing it. I just knew that, you know, I kept going back to it. So I ended up, by the time I was 17, I said, you know, I'm going to join the Army, you know. And so I joined the Army and went in when I just turned 18. And then I went to basic training. And basically, when I went to basic training, I was withdrawing from alcohol and pills and, you know, I took anything and everything when I used. So I went through basic training, and the one thing I could do is, like, I was very athletic, so I could run really. I was a very fast runner, and then I could do push-ups. You know, I could just push-ups all day. I could do sit-ups all day. So I knew, you know, when other guys were struggling with that, I knew I was better at that than they were. So I felt good about that. And then, you know, then marching and stuff, I felt like I was becoming a man, you know, going through basic training. And as soon as we got to AIT, and that's when I started drinking again. And guys are going out, you know, I'm like, well, I'm in the Army, and you know, I'm a man. I can drink now. I'm being responsible, right? I got I live in a barracks, and my rent is paid for, and you know, I got food and everything. So, but anyways, I got through my AIT, and they shipped me to Germany. I went to Hohenfels, Germany, and that was just one constant party of drinking German beer, and then they had this liquid speed over there. It was called X-112. And so I would drink the beer and drink that liquid speed and then, you know, drink all night. And, you know, it was one big party. And I remember shaking when I didn't have a drink. That's when my body would shake. And so I remember after work, I'd get off work and then go into the enlisted man's club. And I'd have to, like, use two hands to take a drink because my hands were shaking. And so I remember after I'd take a drink, and then I'd calm down a little bit, and I'd take another drink, then I became calm. Next thing you know, I'm relaxed. And that's how it was for me. You know, I would calm down, and I felt like it was normal, you know, to be, you know, half drunk all the time and then really drunk, you know. So most of the time, you know. And then, anyway, so then I came back home, and then, you know, I just couldn't stop drinking. And then, so I got out of the service. I went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I was over there, the 101st Airborne Division and then Air Assault. And I was there, and I was having trouble emotionally. I was, you know, my mind was all screwed up, and so anyway, I drank, and I ended up drinking my way out of the Army. And I got out, and, you know, I just drank, and I drank for, I think it was, oh, it was like 3 or 4 years after that. And like I said, I was, I'd work and I'd do different things. I was a tree trimmer, and I worked in landscaping. I cooked and I did different things. But what I would do is I would work, and then I would not show up. And then, you know, because I was hungover, I was drunk, I didn't want to go in. And I'd quit my job before I'd lose it. And sometimes I'd lose my job. I'd get fired. And so again, you know, I just hated my life. I was like, why am I like this? And emotionally, you know, I would react. I got very angry. I had a bad temper, and I was very controlling, and probably a terrible person to be around. And so I was spent a lot of time by myself, and you know, go from place to place, bar from bar, and then, you know, and then I became suicidal. I was, you know, depressed, and, you know, didn't know what to do with myself, didn't know what was wrong with me. And, you know, and I heard about AA, and I was like, I don't know, you know, what AA is about. I wonder if I call them that they'll trace my call and then they'll come get me, or they'll make me go to treatment. Or I had no idea what it was or what treatment was. And so I was reluctant to, you know, to reach out to get help, because I was afraid, you know, like I would go into this process of being locked up. That's another thing. I got locked up for fighting, and then, you know, just a bunch of different things. Drunk driving. I had 3 drunk drivings. And so, you know, I just ended up, and I wanted to die. And then, you know, it was in a jail cell that I just realized that, you know, it was my drinking, and then I needed help. And then I had heard more about treatment. So I went to this treatment center. It was an Indian treatment center in Baraga. It was called New Day. Charlie Shedowin, he was an elder and a substance abuse counselor in our community, him and his wife, Harriet. And the, what they would do is they would take you to AA meetings and take you to powwows, and then and you know you could learn how to make black ash baskets. That was, that's another thing. My grandmother was a black ash basket maker, and so you know, so I learned how to do that. Charlie showed me, and you know, but he took me into treatment, and he told me before, you know, like when we're going, he goes, he was listening to me, and he had insight into, he goes, you're not ready. And I'm like, what do you mean, Charlie? I'm not ready. I'm going to treatment right now. I was like, I don't know how he could figure out I'm not ready. I'm going to treatment. I'm like, what? But what he realized it was at that time when he was taking me, that I wasn't listening. And then I wasn't listening to what he was trying to tell me, and that I couldn't hear him. He realized that. That's why he said I wasn't ready. And he was right. You know, I got there, and then, you know, I got in trouble in treatment, and then I ended up getting kicked out, you know, three-quarters of the way through the program. So then I came back home, and I drank again, and then I ended up going to treatment again, and then, you know, finally, you know, I started, you know, I went to AA meetings in treatment, and things started to click. And that's, you know, that really helped me a lot. Plus, you know, like I share with everybody, I went to my first sweat lodge in treatment in the, you know, in the Indian Treatment Center. And, you know, I thought that was an amazing experience for me. And so that's what helped me too, is I went to that sweat, and then they did a pipe. This guy came in, Mr. Rickley, and he came and did a pipe ceremony. And it just felt so powerful to me, that the way that he did that. There was something special about that pipe ceremony, and there was something special about, you know, the sweat lodge. And so, again, that's the things that I realized too, you know, and I look back, and Charlie said, you know, that treatment center is a very good treatment center for us because we're Indian people, you know? And what he knew, which I didn't know, is that, you know, it had AA meetings. They helped the clients to get, it's, you know, engaged in their recovery by using their culture and, you know, teaching them pride in their identity. And that's what I needed to learn, you know, as how to be proud to be myself as an Indian person. And I watched a film in there, and Phyllis Chelsea, she was one of the stars of that film. It's called The Honor of All. And I seen where, you know, they had the community Alkali Lake, where it was like 95% alcoholic. Even the kids were drinking, and then they got sober. But Phyllis was the first one that got sober. So I watched that movie and documentary on in treatment, and that really made an impact on me. So anyway, I got out, and I liked AA meetings. You know, you know, I struggled to go at first, but once I got there, I always felt better. And that's what, you know, when I got back home, I had a friend named John. He was sober a long time. His name was John Patrick Dunn. And I know you don't mind me saying this over the radio, but he was a very happy guy, and he glowed. He was very friendly. And he was the Irish guy, and he was just so nice and so pleasant to be around. I just was amazed by how healthy he looked. He was an older man, and he said, Patrick, he goes, I like what you said in the meeting. And then, and he seen me kept going to the meetings and stuff. He goes, you need a ride to the meeting? I'll give you a ride. And I said, sure. Anyways, and then I heard, you know, them saying meetings, you need to get a sponsor. And so, that's, you know, I said, I remember, you know, we would go to the big boy after the meeting and talk about, you know, like the meeting and how, you know, the topics related to our life. And John, what he says is, he says, you know, oh, I said, John, would you be my sponsor? And he goes, sure. So, I mean, he accepted me, and I didn't know if he would. I mean, I was afraid of being rejected, you know, because I was so used to being rejected because of my drinking and drugging. My mind was, I just had this tremendous fear of rejection, you know. So anyway, and then me and him would go to the meetings, and I started feeling really good. And I mean, I just fell in love with being sober. And I went to the meetings, and I remember John telling me, he goes, you know, Patrick, I'm going to be good to myself. I'm going to go have a steak tonight. You know, I'm going to have some mushrooms and onions with it. He said, that's how I treat myself. He says, that's what we got to do. We got to be good to ourselves. So I remember I had my first apartment, you know, here sober. And I said, I'm going to get me a steak and then, you know, get some mushrooms and onions. And I'm going to be good to myself. And I remember going to the meeting. I was happy to report, like, I'm being good to myself. I had a steak and with mushrooms and onions, and I'm learning how to be good to myself. And I was very happy. You could see it. And my mother, she says to me, and this is my father had passed away when I was drinking. She said, Pat, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it. Because she's seen me change. And she's seen a hopeless, helpless, miserable person become happy. And that's what happened to me. I became happy and grateful. And John used to say, if you're grateful, gratitude is action. So again, you know, you show that you're grateful. Like you tell people you're thankful for them. You know what I mean? And so he shared with me how to lift other people up. And that's what he did. You know, he was kind of, you know, he'd go around, say positive things to people. He'd say, oh, that's a nice shirt. Or, oh, you got your haircut. That's a nice haircut. Or, you know. And it seemed like everybody that would greet John, they had a big smile on their face, you know, say, hi, John, how you doing, you know? And so I became that person, too. I was friendly, happy, and that's what I got from recovery. So, you know, I talked in a lot of different places because I have, you know, my story goes into, you know, being locked up and, being in a straitjacket in a jail cell and, you know, just a terrible mindset of being suicidal. And so, again, you know, I got to go and tell my story to different people and different groups. And I learned to enjoy to do that, just like tonight. You know, I wasn't sure what I was going to say, you know. When I was sober for 20 years or 21 years, you know, and I got into our culture, I got into fasting, you know, going into doing a lot of sweat lodges. I hooked up with a traditional healer, which was Adam Lusher. He was from Red Lake. He came to here in Sault Ste. Marie. They housed him in Indian Health Services. He was the first traditional healer to work in the Indian Health Services. And he was a very powerful medicine man. And so I got to be his helper because they, you know, people in the community recognized that, you know, that I was spiritual and that, you know, I was into my culture. And so, again, it was a job that was made for me. And so, again, Adam took me and he helped me. And then he taught me a lot of different things. And I still, you know, practice the stuff that he shared with me, and he passed away, oh, it's been about 10 years. But Before he died, he told me to go to Hazelden graduate school. He goes, Patrick, you know, Hazelden would be a good school for you to go to. And this is when I went. I didn't even have any college education at the time, because like I got kicked out of school when I was in seventh grade. So, but going back to Adam, being around him and getting into the culture just helped me to internalize all these good things, these teachings that I got from everybody. And I carry them around with me. You know, the lodge, the teachings of the sweat lodge are in me, the teachings of the pipe, the teachings of AA, you know, one day at a time, you know, things like that, keeping life simple, that all them things I carry around in me. And it's because of, the culture, too. I mean, it's our culture is very, very powerful. And AA is very powerful. And so that's why I started Sober Indians, too. I wanted a place where everybody could meet and not, you know, be, you know, ostracized for being in AA or being in NA or being traditional or being Christian, you know, to make a place. I seen the promise of what Facebook brought in the groups. I was like, you know what, I'm gonna create a group where everybody's welcome, and I'm gonna use these principles and guidelines that I already, you know, I've used, and I've gotten some from AA, I've gotten some from traditional people. And, you know, other wise Christian people. And so I'll use them, and then, I'll have a group for so everybody can be a part of it. And all nations, you know, that's another thing. Dennis Banks, I spent a lot of time with him, and he was a visionary. He was one of the AIM leaders and the founders of AIM. And he was in Wounded Knee at this, you know, the standoff over there in the 70s. And I got to, when I started fasting and everything, I ended up going to Pipestone, Minnesota, and Sundancing. And I went to the AIM Sundance, where I met Clyde Belcourt, Dennis Banks, and then Vernon Belcourt. I met Floyd Westerman, and I mean, just all kinds of like magical people that were, exciting to me. And then going through the Sundance was very powerful for me. I loved it. And I realized when I was out there dancing, that's where I belong too. And that was another thing that helped me internalize a lot of good things, like letting go of stuff. You know, fasting, when you're fasting, you can't control different things. So you have to learn to let go. And so, again, whether you're sitting on a scaffold in a tree, or you're sitting, in a sacred circle on a hill, or Trapper's Rock in a cedar circle, or you're out there on a Sundance and, you know, you're dancing, you have to learn to let go. And you realize, too, when you're fasting that, you know, there's not a lot of things that you need. And it teaches you what you don't need. And so that's what helped me, too, is learning through ceremonies what I didn't need. And so, again, you know, when you deal with life after you fast, of course you're thankful and you're grateful for the water and you're grateful for the food. You know, if you haven't had food in 4 days, it tastes amazing. And if you haven't had water in 4 days, it tastes amazing, you know. And so it's your way of giving back. And it's part of, you know, and, you know, for lack of a better word, a penance that, you know, people pay. And, for me, it was like, I'm dancing for my people And, you know, I'm offering my strength and I'm offering my food and water. And, you know, this is for all that I've taken out of life and not given back, you know? And so, again, it really enhanced my life and my outlook on life. And so I have bad moments, but I don't have bad days. And then, you know, I'm not a prayer warrior, not a worrier, you know what I mean? I pray a lot, and I'm used to it. It's natural for me to pray, and I've learned how to, you know, just take and put whatever it is that if I'm struggling with something into prayer, and that's what happens. Then I let it go, and then, you know, it always turns out good. Whether it's something I have to learn from a painful situation, it's still good. You know what I mean? So that's, you know, that's the exciting stuff that has happened to me because of my road and my recovery process. I'm thankful, you know. And Sober Indians, you know, like I get on there in the morning and I post, like I'll post some kind of positive affirmation and I'm trying to encourage people. That's what I do. You know what I mean? And I've learned, you know, just like my friend Ed say, I mean, I learned not to argue. I mean, I would argue and debate over a lot of things, even in my recovery at first. But now I'm like, I throw the towel and I don't debate with people about stuff because people are going to think what they're going to think. And so I've learned how not to argue, which is a skill and a blessing for me, you know? And so I post what I post, and kind of that's how the group is, too. We don't want people arguing, you know, in there. I mean, share your experience, strength, and hope, you know? Encourage other people. We don't want to, you know, discourage anybody. And also, too, is like what I like to do is I like to treat people as they, you know, like I'd want to be treated. You know what I mean? So I try to say good things to different people. You know, if I'm going to say something bad, I try to keep my mouth shut, which I do most of the time. And I'll let things go and stay out of, an argument or if someone I don't feel is going to, you know, it's going to be a healthy interaction. I try to go around people like that, you know what I mean? And so I've gotten good at that. And so, and then too, you know, like, you know, someone said it, that make your enemies your friends. And then, you know, I've learned to pray for my enemies too, not just because the Bible says so, but it's part of the culture too, is not to hold on to anger. And, you know, people that are gifted and have bundles, you know, they have to, you know, be thinking about good things. If you want to be a healer, you have to really use the love in your heart, not to be angry. You know what I mean? Healing is about love, you know, not about, hurting somebody with your gift. You want to help them. So anyway, I post, and then the peacekeepers, which, you know, they monitor the group all the time, constantly exciting. These are amazing people that I've picked, and other people, peacekeepers have picked other people to come and be in the peacekeeper group, and they're doing quite well. So I see things in people sometimes they don't see in themselves. And so I like to encourage them to, you know, to be that person that they really can be. And so, again, I'm grateful for the peacekeepers. And, you know, they work, you know, from morning till night. There's people that are up all night, and they're from, you know, different parts of the United States and Canada. And, you know, they all supporting each other. And we have our group, that's the Peacekeepers group, and we talk there every day, encourage each other. If there's a problem or something that one can't figure out, then they bring it before the group and we talk about it and, you know, kind of do our little think tank and then, you know, we process it. And so we try to keep the group safe. And that's what, you know, that's what it's about. We have, like I said before, we have people with 60 years of sobriety, 50 years, just multiple people with 50 years, 40 years, just multiple people with 40 years, multiple people with 30 years, like hundreds of people with 30 years in the group. It's amazing. And then we got, you know, hundreds of people with 20, you know what I mean? 10,000, you know? And so again, we got 73,000 members. It's, and you know, you look at the engagement, because we can look at it as administrators, see how engaged people are in the group, and people are actively engaged in Sober Indians constantly, thousands. So that is amazing. And so I feel so good about that, you know, because some people, you know, in Alaska, if they're way out in the bush, there's no AA meeting or there's no sweat lodge even out there, or no church or nothing. All they got is, you know, they're sober Indians. And there's a, don't get me wrong, there's other recovery groups and stuff too. They got that. But we get a lot of people, Native American, First Nation people active in our group because it's Sober Indians. And we have, you know, from the many nations, even in from Mexico. And that's, you know, them are Native American people too. They're our people. They have their own distinct language. You know what I mean? That was just a border that was put up there. They're Indian people. So again, or First Nations people, or, you know, but anyway, it's just exciting to be a part of all that. And it keeps Facebook send me to a leadership summit in California 2 years ago, and because of Sober Indians, and I thought that was pretty cool. They had a film crew come over to my house here in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. They were from California and New York, and they had the film set up and talking, you know, and asking about how the group was developed. And so that was, you know, it just never ends when you're in recovery. You know, it's like you're walking down the road and another beautiful gift appears, you know, and it's exciting. I never ever thought that I'd have a master's degree in addictions counseling or be in doctorate classes and then, you know, understanding what I was doing. And so I'm very grateful, excited for my life, my family, my friends, you know, Sober Indians, my relatives. I'm blessed. And so again, you know, how can you not be grateful when your life is like that? So I'm glad that you asked me to talk, Karen. I know you try to get me on there, and I appreciate that. I like hearing other people talk, and then, you know, I haven't really talked a lot. When I was doing outpatient counseling, I was talking every day. So, you know, when you have two or three groups a day and stuff, you got to do a lot of talking. So I tell you, I know if you could imagine me being shy, introverted, and not wanting to say anything at all, That's how I was. I was very shy, introvert. You couldn't get a word out of me till I was drunk. And then now in my recovery, I've learned everything over. And, you know, I walk around comfortable. I go in the grocery store and I'm comfortable, at peace, you know. And I'm enjoying the benefits of being sober. With long-term recovery, I've been sober since April 2nd, 1988. So April 2nd, I'll have 33 years one day at a time. So, and it's natural for me to be sober. So, I mean, it's like, it's natural for me to pray. It's natural for me to be sober. It's natural for me to problem solve. So I'm a problem solver. And I just, I realized that in my recovery too, that like, you're a problem solver, man. So, that's why, you do what you do. And so I get to talk to all kinds of people from different places, and, they keep me busy, and I enjoy my life. I don't get bored. I'm excited about life. I'm thankful that, I know what I am. I'm a recovering, and you know, you can say recovered, like it says in the big book, we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and to show others how we have recovered. And that's the truth. It's the same way with traditional. Once you're traditional, you learn. You know, when you really practice the culture, you're free. You're new. And Christians, too, when they're born again and they really apply themselves to Christianity, to devoting their life to Jesus or a Muslim, Buddha, they become, you know, independent and healthy, and you develop. But again, recovery is a process. So I keep working on my recovery every day. Even though, you know, I'm, you know, sober all this time, I still have to, you know, grow. Growing is, you know, I'll be growing till I die. And, you know, that's what recovery is about. Hopefully, you know, that's the way I want to die. I want to die sober. That's, you know, I just posted Johnny Cash in Sober Indians. He died. He was sober 11 years. And so I thought that's great. You know what I mean? Things like that, I get inspired by. I get inspired by people that are struggling. I know how it is to struggle to get the first 7 days or the 10 days or the 30 days. I had tears in my eyes when I got my 90-day medallion, you know. I was like, I'm staying sober, because I didn't think it would work. I didn't think it would work for me. So, again, and it did. So, thanks again for asking me. Do you have any questions for me, Karen?
No, you actually covered everything. I did have a question, but I didn't get to ask it. You actually went into it right after I thought about it. But I appreciate you coming on and talking and sharing your story with everyone tonight. It was a really good show.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I want to tell everybody to tune in on Saturday and at 10 p.m. for the next Sober Indian Saturday Night Live show. So everybody have a good night.
Okay, great.
Welcome.
The awesome, awesome shows. And thank you again, Karen, for your dedication to helping us and being in the group. And I know that, you know, you share with me how your life's improving and you feel good about, you know, being a part of it. And you know, it's a big thing to have the show. It does a lot, and it touches a lot of people. So thank you again, and have a good evening, everybody. Thank you, Miigwech, for coming and listening.
You're welcome, and thank you. Good night.